let me make sure that I've got, okay. We'll call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Wednesday, March 4th. We have three public hearings scheduled for today. Public hearing on Senate Bills 11, 249, and 319. And we are going to start out with Senate Bill 11. I'll open a public hearing on that bill. And Beth, could you give us a brief overview?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 11 exempts from lease requirements privately owned structures on state-owned submerged and submersible lands that were constructed prior to January 1, 1916.
Great. Senator Johnson, do you want to kick us off here?
Sure.
And then
May I be joined by my constituent at whose behest this bill is?
That would be great.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, which includes much of Northwest Oregon. That includes an awful lot of waterfront. And Mr. Holcomb is going to describe to you one scenario in what's been a long-running battle in Astoria about the management of the waterfront, and is a problem not unique to Astoria. It's unique to many coastal cities.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Johnson, Senator Edwards, Senator Dembrow, Senator Olson, and Senator Prozanski. Thank you very much for allowing me to come and testify today on SB Senate Bill 11. My short remarks today will be broken down in three areas. And a portion of my written testimony I'd like to leave for you for the record. The first part is the history of the Hanthorn Cannery. The second is the economics of the historical renovation process for old historic buildings. And three, the interactions with the Division of State Lands. The history of the Hanthorn Cannery and the fishing industry goes back to almost 10 years after the Civil War. 1875 was when our building was built. That means 15 years after the state was founded. Hanthorn had come to Oregon to be one of the first canners of salmon, and he came to the shores of the Astoria, Oregon, and Columbia Rivers. And what's so important about this story is that you'll see is that the visionary process of this cannery developed the seafood industry and the cultural history that we have today. Many pictures of fish and salmon on our waterfront and our Capitol building is a result of those efforts in the 1800s. From 1875 to 1897, when the railroad was first coming to Astoria, Hanthorn actually put the first industrial rail spur out to this cannery, built on an island 500 feet from shore. At that time, by 1920, the CRPA discovered a species of fish and it canned it at the Hanthorn Cannery, and then it was labeled bumblebee. This fish was the albacore tuna that we all know today. It was founded in the Hanthorn Cannery. By 1956, the CRPA controlled the world of fish, and Astoria became the world headquarters of bumblebee seafood, but unfortunately, it moved its headquarters to San Francisco in 81, but the building remained and took over another small business called Astoria Seafoods, which employed hundreds of Astorians that were out of work because of bumblebee's move. This facility that we're talking today is 122,000 square feet sitting on about 2 acres of water and an island 500 feet from the shores of the Columbia River. I purchased it in 2002 at the direction of, at that time, the director of Division of State Lands, Ann Hounis, who asked me to come to look at this building and see if I could save it for historical renovation because of the importance of this particular building to the state history as well as to the community of Astoria that had put hundreds of families through college, generations of people that worked at this facility. I signed a lease for about 15 years with an additional option for an additional 15 years. And so the economics of this is really important because trying to renovate a building over the Columbia River 500 feet from shore is not an easy process. It costs a lot of money, a lot of permitting, the special types of wood, and especially for a building that was built 140 years ago. Imagine, if you will, buying a house, and you take a 30-year mortgage, and you know what percentage rent you have, or a percentage of your loan is, and you have a certain fee, and about halfway through that 30-year mortgage, the bank comes and says, hey, we're tripling your monthly payments. Do you think you could afford that? Not knowing what you need to do? And this, unfortunately, is what happened to us here at the Hanthorn Cannery, where we exercised our option last year, unfortunately, in Division of State Lands, who I'm not in common with. I helped the Division of State Lands create a bill that your body passed that for every submarine cable that lands in Oregon, $250,000 would go to the Common School Fund. So I'm very familiar with the Division of State Lands. But when I saw this letter come back and says, we're not going to recognize your option for renewal, and that we're tripling your lease fee, it all of a sudden put an economic hurt on the abilities to renovate this historic building. Now, mind you, of the almost 15 years I've been at the Hanthorn County renovating it, yes, we've been able to bring in businesses. We have Rogue, we have Coffee Girl, we have lawyers. But this is critically necessary for us to be able to renovate the building. For it wasn't for those individuals coming here in a business perspective, we would not have the money to renovate the building. The other important thing that I'd like to point out today is that we receive hundreds of school children every year that come out to our museum, which is 50% of our facility. A museum that explains the history and culture of our organization and how it's impacted the state. So on an educational perspective, I definitely understand the Common School Fund. But I look at tripling the lease fees of our lease to maintain it is now putting it over the top where we ourselves are matching, if not concluding, the amount of education and funds to save that building. Just for an example, a 4x1220 costs $70. Just to get to the Hanthorn Canyon, you have to cross a 500-foot bridge. It costs $80 a board. So every time that I see that our costs increase, I look at the cost of replacing one of those boards just to get to the island that Hanthorn built the cannery on 140 years ago. So I ask I ask all of you to move this bill forward to the Senate floor for a vote. I think it's important for the historical aspect of our business, the ability for us to move forward and continue educating the public about what the foundation of our state really was, and to look at the fact that it's challenging for anybody to want to go out and restore historical buildings if they don't know what the future is going to lie when it comes to cost. If this ability for them to triple our lease fees, I can tell you that it's going to be very difficult to continue to operate that facility. And I would be now happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you. You had mentioned that you have law offices in there. I assume that the lawyers walk on the water to get there.
Yes.
No, a question is, and I digress, but the question that I have is, why did they suddenly want to triple your rates and not expand your lease that you had planned for years?
Well, you can see that the building at the time I got it, when Director Hannes asked me to invest in our family funds into this building, it was falling down. Nobody really wanted it. It just looked like a building that was hanging over the river, like a lot of Astoria buildings that are eventually fell in the water and no longer there. So we had to get those businesses out there so that we could create the money to do the restoration. And again, if it wasn't for those businesses and lawyers and doctors and psychologists, coffee shops to come out, we wouldn't be able to get to the place we are today. And so to answer your question, I think from the road and from the railroad tracks and in Astoria, wow, this old cannery building now has it looks fantastic. Well, they must be making a lot of money, and therefore we're going to go ahead and raise your lease fees. What they really don't realize, and I need to tell you this, since Steve Purchase retired almost 8 years ago, I've never met anybody from Division of State Lands. Every year we have our scuba shop does a party where we get everybody together and we clean up the waterfront. We dive under the water, we pull out tires, we do waterfront cleanup. We never had any letters from DSL, thank you for cleaning up our waterfront, thank you, we want to help you sponsor an educational tour. We just haven't heard from them.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, if I and Senator Olson, if I could speak to the issue. It is the conversion of the use from a marine use or a river dependent where they were canning fish or in that interregnum when the building was falling down. and then you put commercial in, and I think, and DSL can speak for themselves, but I think it's the conversion then to commercial that triggers the increase. And I was just speaking to DSL, because this isn't unique to Hanthorn. The age of the Hanthorn cannery and the community gravitational pull around it as a historical kind of galvanizer for the fish industry. There's another situation where Bumblebee had an ice house. Bornstein Seafood had an ice house, and the last time I was in it, the ice on the walls was like this. I thought it was going to fall in the river. Some young entrepreneurs took it over and turned it into a brew pub and redid the building. It's absolutely beautiful. They're brewing beer in it. It's maybe Senator Prosiansky is familiar with it. It's a buoy beer.
I know of it.
And they're brewing beer, and out of an ice house that was practically falling in the river, they now have 20 jobs. The result is that because of the conversion to a commercial lease, DSL immediately increases their lease threefold from $5,000 to $15,000. This is now an up-and-coming business with young entrepreneurs. They don't know if they're going to be able to survive the rent increase as they get their budding business off the ground, their budding beer business off the ground. And I know the community is very enthusiastic about maintaining the character and the sense of place of Astoria by repurposing some of these older buildings. And it becomes fiscally so challenging with the rent increases. Now, DSL did inform me at the beginning of this hearing that there has been a petition for rulemaking, and that when the land board is up to strength, and again, I'll ask them if they would, if I'm making any factual errors here, to undertake rulemaking to see perhaps is there a way to change the rate scale as older historic buildings convert from their original purpose to other commercial purposes, so that these entrepreneurs or historians aren't just crushed by the burdensome rates charged by DSL, albeit for a good reason. I mean, it's for the kids, but I don't want to put 20 jobs that just were created out of business because of an onerous rent schedule when we're trying to find a balance between supporting schools and encouraging entrepreneurs, particularly in Senator Prosiansky's favorite industry segment.
Follow up. 4 years ago, we were involved in a small bill on gill netting, and I had the fortune to go to Astoria to do a lot of research, and I saw the historical pictures and stuff of Bumblebee, and I haven't seen it since you've improved it, but this sounds like, you know, we need to really look at this closely to make certain that people that want to bring in these historic things don't suffer because they improve them and save them for the future.
Yes, thank you very much.
You've just summed up the bill, Senator Olson. Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I just conclude by saying I was at one of the first events that the Hanthorn Cannery put on, which was a reunion of tuna packers. And they were largely women, and at this point in time, they're largely older women. Many of them were Chinese. Many of them hadn't seen each other in four decades, but they'd worked the tuna lines when there were hundreds of employees there. And it was such a joy to watch these older women who hadn't seen each other, and they all had on Hanthorn t-shirts, falling into each other's arms, talking about the good old days when salmon were so plentiful in Astoria and jobs so abundant, and the camaraderie and the fellowship and the friendship that they developed working at Hanthorn Cannery.
Thank you very much. And we have those every year, by the way.
I do have a couple of questions myself. So you said you went for your, you wanted to exercise your option?
Yes, Senator, we asked.
And they wouldn't know. Could you explain?
Yes. So when we first signed the lease, we took the lease over from the cannery that was going bankrupt and Honda Finance had it in structure. So we assumed the lease from Honda Finance at that time. And the DSL individual explained to us that we had just assumed the lease. The lease had a 15 years at a certain rate, increasing 3% a year because of Measure 50. And that there was at the end of 15 years, we'd have an option to extend it. So Steve Purchase at that time told me, said, Floyd, when you get down to November, just go ahead and send a letter to DSL, and we'll go ahead and exercise the option, continue on for the next 15 years. When we did it, we received a letter from DSL that says, we're going to renegotiate your lease, which that's where the number came from. And they also said, look, if you don't agree to this, which then I called Senator Johnson's, you'll have to remove your historic structure within 30 days. Well, That was the part where I said, "There's no way that we could, how do we go to SHPO? How do we go through the, how do we hire architects? What are you saying?" So it really added to the challenge that we had. They said, "There's no way that the public is going to allow me to remove a historic structure like the Hanthorn Cannery in 30 days off the waterfront." And I wrote back to them and such. So. So to this day, you know, I can understand the OARs, but they recently changed the OARs. Senator Johnson, just a reminder, they came to town and said, "Look, we're going to change the rules." We both sat down together and complained that, you know, be careful about changing these rules because there's a lot of businesses that are already in process. However, none of our testimony ever really made it to the OARs, and they would go ahead and increase the fees, which now I think are really challenging for historic buildings.
Thank you for that. Additional background information. My other question is so we're speaking currently about Hanthorn Cannery. I presume there are other buildings that this would apply to. Do we have any idea how many?
Is this less and less every year, unfortunately?
Nonetheless, is it hundreds or is it five or is it three?
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I think it is a quantifiable number. I don't know what it is right now. I just looked over my shoulder and saw Senator Roblin sitting in the audience. Coos Bay has had all sorts of issues with DSL asserting jurisdiction over a lot of their waterfront, and he's nodding his head in the affirmative. I think we could quantify this. The ice house converted to the brew pub that I just mentioned is not the same vintage as Hanthorn, but certainly part of the historic fishery structures of the Astoria waterfront. And we can make an effort to try to quantify not only how many buildings, but what the rent computes to if you monetize it up and down the coastal landscape.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Dimmer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I may have missed this, but the date of January 1st, 1916, what's special about that date?
Well, I was in the third grade, and things were going really pretty well.
Now, you and I are the same age, Senator.
A lot of people have asked me that. Matter of fact, the waterfront, once the spill hit the town slopes, everybody called and said, "Floyd, what's with 1916? Mine's at 1914, and mine's at 1923, and how's this going to affect our businesses?" And I said, "Well, I think the way I read this, it's 100 years. So if passed, would go in effect to the year of 2016. Of course, if you have a 100-year-old building, you know, you should be able to be covered by such a bill."
I shouldn't have been, Mr. Chair and committee, I shouldn't have been teasing. We picked it on the centennial.
Right. Yes, just follow up. I'm worried about those buildings that are 1918, 1920. Are we going to hear from them?
I do know the Bowie Beer was 1923.
Right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if this bill moves forward, we'd be more than happy not only to quantify, but also we would accept amendments on the dates. The 100 years was arbitrary because it was easy to remember and had a nice sort of historic ring to it.
Unfortunately, the 100 years is in the relating clause. Oh, no, it's not. Excuse me. No, it's not. That's in the summary. Yeah. I'm getting more and more interested in this from this morning until now, because in Senate Finance and Revenue this morning, we had a hearing on a tax credit proposal for renovating historic buildings. And Senator Boquist was sitting to my right, and he strategically, I think, made sure that he brought to light this situation and situations like this, where we are contemplating doing a fairly sizable tax credit for renovating historic buildings that have a special place in our communities, and then on the other hand, we have situations like this. So he asked his question strategically, and then I said, "Wait a minute, we have a bill about this." And this afternoon, he said, "Yeah, I know you do." So,
well, Mr. Chair, we would be happy to get the committee administrator whatever additional information she needed in order to receive favorable consideration by the committee, and we'll go do whatever due diligence and report back to you.
Sure. Mr. Chair Wilson, in your due diligence, could you perhaps research those buildings that are in that realm of the 100 years, like 75 years in past, because 75-year-old building is really, you know, an antiquated building, and find out what that number is from the 100-year to maybe the 80-year mark, so we could take a look perhaps if those buildings are of significance, that we could make an amendment to do that, to incorporate those.
Sure.
Would that be okay, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you
I will, who should I send? Give these two?
Give it to the nice lady right there.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next up on this particular bill, we've got Peter Marsh.
Yeah.
Come on up. Senator Roland, would you like to testify on this bill?
I kind of want.
Well, I don't particularly want. It's really up to you.
I'm glad
you're here for another
you're
bill.
Asking,
I was hoping we could close this bill out, though, before
so
we go on to your bill.
Can I come up to
please. Yeah. Please, Commissioner.
Okay. Uh-oh. Captain Sensitivity.
So, Senator, why don't you start this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Arne Roland, Senate District 5. My great-grandfather was a gillnutter on the Columbia River at precisely this time, actually, at the turn of the last century. And his gillnutting license is hanging on my wall in my office. And I am sure in 1916 he was selling to this particular place. And so understanding and in our family history, the up and down the coast for a lot of our family that fished and logged, some of these things are really impressive. And having been close friends with a doctor that put a lot of money into the Historical Museum in Astoria, and having spent part of my ninth grade running around Astoria trying to figure out what all the historical buildings were, what they've done in Astoria is pretty remarkable with regard to saving a lot of those historical buildings. And these waterfront buildings are really unique. They cost a lot of money to maintain because of the substructure that's underneath them, and to remove them after they've been fixed up would be a disaster. So I encourage you to find a way to help Senator Johnson and the people continue to maintain these buildings and do whatever it takes to keep them functioning as a building, and that means raising from funds, and I'd be glad to help in any way I could to see that this building survives.
Let me go next.
Okay. My name is Peter Marsh. I didn't grow up in Oregon, as you can hear. I grew up in England, where historical preservation is a lifetime job. But I've adopted the Lower Columbia for the past 12 years, and I'm the chairman of the Hanthorn Foundation, which runs the museum on the pier, which is owned by Mr. Holcomb. And some thoughts about the museum there is that it's free to enter. It's open 7 days a week, and we get a huge amount of traffic through. We get everything from children to the senior groups you've heard, the senior former employees and just senior travel groups. And on the lower end of the age scale, I think it's really important that these young people in Astoria who are really losing touch with their roots and can come down to the pier and they can find out where their parents worked, where their grandparents worked, and about the traditions that still hold in the city. And that's something that we're very happy to accept, and we're developing better displays. And we have won the Class of Heritage grant last year in order to redo the lighting in the pier, which I think is about 1920s vintage inside the museum right now. So we're investing in that in order to improve its appearance. And we do all this through donations, and Mr. Holcomb doesn't charge us any rent. And we have a considerable space in there. And in fact, he spends a great deal of his time working on historic matters, and he assists with the museum. And he really is, surprisingly enough, a businessman who really cares about the past as well as the future there. I think that's all I need to say.
Thank you. Well, I'm the fossil. My name's Terry Thompson.
Yeah.
I fished for this company when it was Bumblebee Seafoods in 1954. I think 7 was the first delivery I made there. That was before the bridge was actually built there, and watched the bridge start the construction in Astoria. This is unique in that it is truly a great part of Astoria's history and the Columbia River's history. There was a huge gillnet fishery. In fact, I had the opportunity to run one of the gillnet packer boats when Bumblebee Seafoods owned that plant, and went up and down the river when they had a strike and helped the gillnetters get their fish back to the cannery. To lose this structure would be a tremendous loss to the state of Oregon, and Floyd has done a great job of refurbishing that facility. He invited me in to see it when he first bought it, and I went, oh my gosh, nobody can bring this back. He's done it, and it's a beautiful job. It's a well worth the investment and time. One of the problems you have, though, a lot of times with these kinds of structures is the buildings look good on top, and people make the assessment on what looks on top. They have wood pilings underneath them, and luckily in the Columbia River, you're fresh enough at that location that it doesn't get the barnacles and torpedoes like you do down in Newport, which is the area I represent. I'm from Lincoln County. So to do a thorough analysis on a building is very, very difficult, and it costs a lot of money to get a pile buck underneath there and start to do that work. Floyd's done a lot of it, and I think he's actually been doing some of it himself. But it's a huge structure. I think it's a very important structure. Now, there are other structures like this in the state, but in Newport, in my area, we're still using them as fish canneries. And hopefully they will stay fish canneries, but some of these buildings may someday in the future have a similar fate and be used for something else, and I'd like to see a structure built to maintain that. One of the things that upsets me when I heard this, and you have a small marginal business, you need a graduated increase in fees. When you come up and hand them a threefold increase, you'll impact almost any business. So if you do move forward with an increase in fees, try to make it so that it's on an incremental basis over time so a person can build it into their business model. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Yeah. For Senator Roblin. Before you get out of here, Coos Bay, does it have any structures that could fit this requirement?
Most of our structures Astoria was the first city to get a land exchange with the state so that they could actually own part of the downtown that had been filled because the historic sale plan. So they got taken care of that. We've worked most of that out in Coos Bay now. State lands have been really good and helpful. Our last little piece on the bay that we had a concern is our old central dock, which used to be the major dock in our whole community for exporting tough lumber and wood. And it's in real bad disrepair. We've taken part of that now. It's being used by the historical museum that we just built in Coos Bay. All of that land has been taken except for where the pilings are out in the water. And we're hoping to get someone to come in and buy that next piece of land and then start rebuilding it. And we hope restore those docks, which is the same thing we do here, because that would be a really great thing to see happen in our area. So the docks left, but most of the other buildings. There's a few old-time buildings right down on the waterfront. There's a foundry and other things that used to build all the donkeys for our early industry. They've saved it. It's in the same shape it was in the 1940s and 30s. It's the same machinery, and it's really pretty amazing. The family's trying to keep that up, and they're okay with respect to the property now. So yes, we have some of those historical buildings. I think most of them have gone through the process and gotten some of the stuff cleared. Some of that's out on piers, so I would say I haven't talked to the people yet, but they might be interested in it. They haven't got anything going right now, so they're just paying whatever taxes they have. So yeah, I would say there would be a few buildings left that are of that vintage that could use this kind of thing.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Yeah. Okay, thank you. So I don't have anybody else signed up, but is anybody from the department that would like to come on up? Maybe answer some questions, share your perspective. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. Chair Edwards, member of the committee. I'm Chris, for the record, I'm Chris Castelli with the Oregon Department of State Lands. I'm a policy analyst.
And I'm Bill Ryan, assistant director with the department. And Chris is actually the expert on these issues, so I'm going to let him field questions.
So your understanding of this bill would be that, and I want to make sure that I'm clear that I understand what the bill does. So it is the conversion from the conversion to commercial that triggered this, triggered the increase from your perspective.
Chair Edwards, yeah, my understanding of what triggered the change in the rate was the change in the authorized use. I understand Mr. Holcomb referenced that it was a cannery before. That would have been under our waterway leasing rules, a marine industrial use. My understanding is that out on the pier now, there are a number of restaurants and coffee shops. Those are considered under our current administrative rules, non-marine use, not water dependent. So that is, those uses are at our highest leasing rates.
Okay, so issue about whether or not Mr. Holcomb was able to exercise his option, I mean, that issue notwithstanding, is the bill, would it affect other other properties that are marine industrial also built prior to 1916, or would this be just commercial properties that were built prior to 1916?
Chair Edwards, my reading of Senate Bill 11 as is that it would exempt any privately owned structure on state and submerged commercial lands that was constructed prior to that date.
Okay, whether so it be regardless of, okay, okay. So for some structures that are currently being assessed a lease rate based upon, say, a marine, for example, a marine industrial classification, they would actually go from paying that to paying less.
Sure.
Paying nothing. Is that, do I understand that correctly?
Chad Words, that would be correct. They would be exempt from our leasing program. Okay. So they would be eligible for a registration, and there's a minimal fee associated with our registrations.
Okay. That's my only immediate. Oh, well, I guess I do have one other question. Do you have any historical perspective about why Mr. Holcomb wasn't able to exercise that option? I mean, it seems to me, from a planning purpose, you know, I was as I was listening to the first panel's testimony, I was thinking, well, that's kind of not really fair. Well, there's a responsibility for somebody that's, you know, for planning purposes to kind of know what's, you know, what's coming at them, and if they change it, and then it would go into a new category. I mean, it seems like there could have been better communication, but now it sounds like, and this is not a court, but it sounds like he would have believed that he did have the option to continue under the old schedule. So I'm trying to understand that better.
Sure, Chair Edwards. So I did not work on this lease, this file.
Okay.
My understanding from just listening to the testimony is that at least the authorized use had changed over time. So a lease, which is a contract, is for a specified area, mm-hmm. and a specified use, and that right to renew typically goes along with that for a couple reasons. First of all, we have circulated this lease initially representing that it was for a certain area and a certain use. It was sent to local land use agency for a review and approval for a specified area and a specified use. So I would think from listening to it that it didn't meet the right to renewal based on a change of use, and that's why it was revisited at that time. I'd be more than happy to get more information on the specific lease if you'd like and come back and talk with you guys further.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Senator Olson.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do you have any rules in your books for historic lands other than marine lands, such as like a museum in high desert or an old building, a 1900s building that might be in Canby? Do you have any rules that are similar to this, but they are related to just land structures?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I don't believe that we do. We do have some provisions in these waterway leasing rules for historic vessels and maybe structures, but they have to meet a specific criteria, but not for our upland uses. No, we don't have anything for that.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Have you ever had a situation in your experience where someone has come in and renovated an old structure and, you know, maybe put a restaurant in it or something like that, and then you change the lease requirements for that? in your experience?
In my experience, so Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson. I'm trying to think if I did. I was a land manager for the Southwest Coast for quite some time. And I would think that we probably did, but I'm not thinking of one that comes to mind right now. But I'm sure there were similar situations where the use was changed, even which and the lease rates and the contract were changed accordingly.
Follow up. My inquiry is only to determine if there has been a precedent set for other types of structures. That's my inquiry.
Sure. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, it is our policy and our current practice under administrative rule that if a change to use or area occurs, that we revisit the lease or the activity at that time.
Then I'd follow up on that
one.
It seems quite interesting that you would not stimulate, I don't know what the word is, but kind of allow people to come in and make improvements and perhaps, you know, to have an improvement that could advantage them to make some money to help make more improvements, and then you turn around and penalize them because they improved it. It just really doesn't, kind of makes me just scratch my head a little bit. And that's just a comment. I'm sorry.
Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Ms. Chair. I'm just wondering, following up on the idea that Senator Johnson had about coming up with a more graduated schedule. How do you respond to that suggestion?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, I don't know if you have in front of you, we did provide some testimony, Director Abrams did, with regards to this bill. And I think the department would entertain looking into that. We feel the appropriate venue would be rulemaking. Like I said, we have a set of administrative rules for waterway leasing. And in that case, we could also take advantage of a rulemaking advisory committee of affected stakeholders who could help us take a look at that.
It seems to me that there's merit for wanting to keep in check or lower the lease costs for this type of a renovation. But as I was, you know, I was looking at my notes and thinking about what's being contemplated here, it sounds like the existing rules don't contemplate well or adequately renovation scenarios. And I think there's a public interest in maintaining that as a viable option in situations like this. But perhaps the rules kind of work counter to that. I don't know. Yeah, so I mean, I'm thinking this through, particularly for historic structures. It seems like there's a merit here. I'm not sure how to best thread that needle, and hopefully the committee, you know, members working with other members of the legislature and stakeholders can continue to noodle on this a little bit more. Senator Przonski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the things I'm hearing from the dais, and I guess it's been puzzling to me, when you have someone come in and take this type of risk and they're told that this is what their lease is going to provide for, then they're going to have an option. Do you know whether or not they actually are put on some notice that if they actually change the use, in this case from marine use to some other type of use, that could in fact, one, subject them to a higher lease? Well, first of all, the option's not going to be able to be executed. And then secondly, that they're basically now going to be considered a different use and be have a different structure of lease payments.
Mm-hmm. Chair Edwards, Senator Przonski, I'm not terribly familiar with the specific lease. I think our rules do delineate that would occur and the lease would be reevaluated as the use changed or if an area was expanded. But I don't know if the appropriate staff were working with the lessee closely and providing that sort of communication.
Okay. I guess one final piece of information that would be helpful for me in understanding in getting some context here is what type of numbers are we talking about? I mean, are we talking about tens of thousands of dollars a year, thousands of dollars a month if you triple? And the reason I ask is because I was just as I was listening to Commissioner Thompson talk about other historic sites up and down the coast that are currently canneries, and hopefully they stay canneries. Are they canneries, but for the cost of converting to some? I mean, you know, if their lease were to triple, does that make the economics such that it doesn't make sense to convert to commercial, and so that kind of keeps them as canneries? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering how much more complicated is this issue than what we're trying to work out here on the dais? And clearly we're not going to do anything with the bill today, but clearly also I'm interested in trying to take care of a problem.
Right. So Chair Edwards would be happy to come back with some more information for you. I can show you what our lease rates are for different categories. I can tell you lowest is log rafting, which we hardly have any of in Oregon anymore, and then the most expensive is the non-marine rate. Marine industrial is on the higher end. Marine industrial would be canneries, but it is less than the non-marine rate. I would also think that maybe local land use law and zoning plays into how many canneries could be actually converted to retail type establishments. But for us, yeah, the rate is higher. It's higher for non-marine uses, yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you both for being here. We do have other business to conduct today. This has actually been a pretty interesting hearing and went longer than I had anticipated going. But we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 11 for now, or we're just going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 11 and move on to the next item on the agenda, which is Senate Bill 319. We're going to open up a public hearing on that right now. And Senator Roblin and Gabriella Garb, you want to kick us off here? And Beth, you want to give us a brief summary?
Senate Bill 319 requires proprietary authorization and a removal fill permit from the Department of State Lands to construct or operate ocean renewable energy facility in Oregon's territorial sea. There's a -3 amendment on OLIS that would remove a section from the bill establishing the policy of the state and requires that DSL convene a committee to assist in evaluating whether to establish a general permit or general authorization.
All right.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. For the record, Arnie Roblin, Senator from District 5. This bill originated out of conversations a number of years ago, and 2 years in particular, when we came to the conclusion that putting a wave energy device in the ocean had to get a permit from Water Resources for and a water right. And since it made no sense to me that we had water rights in the ocean because of the plentifulness of water in the ocean, that we needed to have some other ability to regulate the introduction of those devices into our nearshore. And so we looked around and we had some conversations and we finally came back to Division of State Lands and the idea that how could we get a regulatory handle to help when somebody wants to put a device in the ocean to have that regulatory hook into whoever it is so that we can make sure that they remove it if they are going to go away, that they do it the way we think they should, and so that we can put parameters around how they install those devices in the ocean. We've had some bills that come through that have explained some of that information, but who is going to be the regulatory person to handle that? After the discussions, we came to the conclusion that DSL was the place and that removal fill was the opportunity. And as we built the original bill and put it out there for people to look at, we started getting a lot of conversations around it. And in particular, Section 2, which was really the section that's being removed. So I convened a little work group to talk about it with some fishermen and with energy people, and we came up with the first attempt, which was number one. That did not meet the requirements that everybody had set forth to basically do no harm and to make it happen right. So we went to number two. Number two created some other issues that we got information back from both people, so we decided we could go to three. So amendment number three is the attempt that I think came to the conclusion that everybody could agree to. It basically allows us to have the requirement to put DSL in the driver's seat with respect to the ability to regulate this new industry. It took a water right out and replaced it with the idea that you're going to have removal fill, because when you put it in the ocean, you're going to do something. The conversation had got a little bit more interesting when we started talking about these devices that only go in for 6 months or a year to do testing. And we have a couple places on the Oregon coast, Newport being the number one, where we have PMAC, and then out farther, NIMREC, which actually are testing buoys that allow people to come out and test their particular devices. And we didn't really want to get in the way of that. We really wanted to figure out, could there be an expedited way to figure out how to get them in the ocean for those short periods of times. And we realized that as on land, when you do a removal fill permit, if you're doing less than 50 yards of material, there's a general permit you can get, which is much easier to get than going through the whole process that you have to do for removal fill. That became a conversation, and in the bill you will see the stuff that we entered into allows for a process which would allow fishing interests and other wave energy device interests and the state to come together to come up with some rules on how do we write that removal fill permit that's a general permit that would allow us to do the research that we think is really important on the coast. And we think for the foreseeable future it's probably where we're going to spend most of our time in this business, because we would love to be the place where people come and make devices and send them off all over the world, helping them find their energy. And I think what we've come to agree with is that we've had fishermen engaged, and where that research will take place, we're moving forward on some of that stuff. We wanted to make sure that we came up with a process that allowed that to happen and still gave us the regulatory authority of the state to encourage them to do it right. So with that, I'll turn it over to Gabriella. Thank you for, and she was one of the people who was in the work group that always was there to help. So.
Great. Thank you, Senator Roblin. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. I'm Gabriella Goldfarb with Governor Kate Brown's office, and I'm here testifying in support of SB 319, sponsored by Senator Roblin and his colleagues in the Coastal Caucus. And Senator Roblin really covered very robustly many of the aspects that I was going to talk about, so I will try and shorten my comments to just give you a flavor of the context for why all of this came about. And I have to make a bit of a detour into the federal landscape regulating ocean energy. So under federal law, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, has preemptive authority to regulate what they call hydrokinetic energy projects, and that means projects that generate electricity from waves or directly from the flow of water in ocean currents, tides, or inland waterways. And that locus of federal authority resulted in FERC issuing a ream of preliminary permits in Oregon's territorial sea in the mid-2000s without the state having much or any of a role. And the state had to respond quickly. We settled on the Water Resources Department's authority to issue water rights and hydroelectric licenses, and that appeared to be the best mechanism that we could get quickly into place to ensure that the state would have a seat at the table. And, you know, so in other words, we directly imported the regime that we have for river hydroelectric projects and plopped it in the ocean. And this was an awkward fit, as Senator Roblin alluded. It, you know, makes sense that you need to allocate the finite resources of water resources of a river with a water right and a hydroelectric license, but it doesn't make sense in the ocean. So the rush by the wave energy developers to lay claims to the state waters prompted the state to amend the territorial sea plan to set policies and a spatial plan for ocean energy development in state waters. And it put the Department of State Lands, rather than the Water Resources Department, in the role of lead agency. We completed that plan in 2013. We submitted it to FERC for approval as a comprehensive plan, and we got that approval, and now FERC now has to consider that plan in its licensing process. But more significant from a legally binding perspective is that we were also able to seek and to obtain approval from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, to make the plan part of our federally approved coastal management plan. And under federal law, if something is part of an enforceable policy is part of our federally approved plan, we get something called federal consistency review authority, and that requires that any action the federal government takes that affects our ocean or coastal resources has to be consistent with our approved policies. And so the final step to getting us this strong voice at the table, which is captured in this bill, it makes, for the most part, what are technical changes to Department of State Land's existing authorities to be consistent with the Territorial Sea Plan and how DSL implements its regulatory removal fill authority and its proprietary or landlord-type authorization for this emerging clean energy use. It effectively removes the Water Resources Department and the water right from the process, except in extremely narrow circumstance, and it provides statutory recognition, your authorization of DSL's role as the lead agency. And I will leave it at that, and if you have there are more nuances to the bill, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I have agency folks in the room as well to help me out when I can't answer them. So thank you for your time and attention.
Mr. Olson, just one.
The necessity of the emergency clause?
We have, from my perspective, we have groups and people who are out there already testing devices. We've already had one problem where they didn't get the permit before they got the stuff in and before they got it back out because it was just to test it. And so it has resulted in some miscues along the way in the last couple of years, which I think could be prevented if we could have a process that makes sense to everybody. And so they get the permit before they put it in the water, and then they have to get the permit to take it out, and they've already done both before stuff gets done. Hopefully this will allow that to happen, especially for the test things. That's where I think the most likelihood is that we're going to have buoys and stuff out in the water.
And we don't need that 8 to 10 month gap.
That's correct.
Thank you.
So does the department currently have authority to do this? They currently have authority.
Yes, they are excuse me.
They have authority to do a removal fill kind of permits.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't applied it to this particular industry before, have we?
If I may, so Chair Edwards and committee members, so DSL as the landlord for our submerged lands has had the removal fill authority and also the proprietary use authorization, in other words, charging somebody rent and making conditions as a landlord. But the way that was all set up in statute was not quite aligned with what we adopted in the Territorial Sea Plan and the policies there relating to this new use, because their program didn't contemplate ocean energy. So there's a lot of technical fixes. That's why it is such a long bill, because it's amending all these particular parts of their existing, authorities and program to tweak it to make it work for ocean energy.
Okay. And there was also, I wouldn't say a conflict, but some of the regulating authority was in Water Resources as opposed to DSL because of this water right issue that didn't make a lot of sense.
So, Chair Edwards and members of the committee, the way it worked is that Water Resources was the convening authority and had to issue a water right and had to go through all this administrative stuff and spend resources that really weren't necessary. They had to convene all the other agencies, including DSL, but DSL was really the one who was carrying out most of the work. And so this new regime acknowledges that reality and takes Water Resources out of the mix.
Okay. Questions? Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Signed up, we have Terry Thompson and Ono Husing. I apologize if I did not pronounce your name correctly.
That's not the first time.
Well, actually,
that's my guess.
I think you meant Thompson, Captain Sensitivity.
Oh, man. Terry Thompson, past state representative and now Lincoln County Commissioner, and been involved in the fishing industry. First of all, let me say that I want to thank Arnie Roblin and his staff and the governor's office for working out this bill. The original bill had us concerned, and the -3 amendments makes a bill that we think is a good bill. So it's nice to be able to come up here and support this bill. The only thing that even worries us a little bit is the committee that's formed under Section 14. Like any committee, it's always difficult. We worry that there'll be a balanced committee, but we have to trust that when it's created,
it will be a fair committee, so all parties will be there and represented. But we support the bill.
The pronunciation is Ono Husing, and I'm the director of the Lincoln County Planning and Development Department. Terry
I got
Thompson.
Them both wrong. Not Ono Husing.
Oh, I've heard some
Husing or Husing?
Husing.
Husing.
I've heard some real doozies over my life, so you actually, that was pretty good. So just pleasure to be here. I'm Terry Thompson's chauffeur today because you heard his arm hauling a bucket of herring, right? Talk about
no, don't start with the war story.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I can only go so far.
How many herring did you catch last weekend?
Get to the point.
I have nothing further to add. I just want to add the very good collaborative effort and thank you. And in the future, if you deal with these issues, please make sure you get a bunch of opinions because trying to make the territorial sea plan work and these new energy issues, it's very complicated and nuanced. And there are a lot of different views, and so we look forward to helping you in the future if there are any further issues on this matter to help you understand that it is complicated and a number of different people need to be involved. Thank you.
All right. I do have a question. Several years ago, or a couple years ago, we talked about ocean reserves. Does this impact ocean reserves?
Marine reserves, you mean?
Marine reserves, yeah. Does it intertwine with them, or?
Not this bill directly, no. Marine reserves is another issue. I'd love to sit down and talk to you about any
please
time.
Don't. Please
but now's not
in
the time.
Office,
this
yeah.
bill
now
is just
not the time.
No, I just thought about the marine reserves we have, and now we have this in there, and I wondered if there was an interconnect or if these are far from the marine reserves. Or.
They are an interconnect in that they're creating, when as we create these different zones in the ocean, it reduces the amount of productive food production that's capable from the ocean. Now, some people will say that that doesn't necessarily so because the fish are protected in when you make spatial planning. But as you add more and more things into spatial planning, eventually it will reduce the amount of capabilities of harvestable areas in the ocean.
That's exactly the question I wanted to ask. Thank you.
He's talked about this before. Any other questions?
I know better.
Thank you both. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 319 that has not signed up? Okay. Seeing nobody else, it's not posted for a work session, so we're just having a hearing today. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 319, and we're going to go to the next item on the agenda and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 249.
Hey. So look, commotion. Where's the law at?
What's that?
It's a commotion back there.
Happens when we get a fisherman in the group.
That's right. Wanna,
yes.
Summarize for us, Beth.
Yes, Chair Edwards and committee members. Senate Bill 249 would allow payments for off-site compensatory mitigation credits to continue and to be made if credits from the mitigation bank were not available at the time the department began developing the off-site mitigation project and that project expenses have not been fully recovered. There is a -1 amendment on OLIS that clarifies the payment for offsite compensatory mitigation credits are allowed to be made to the organ removal fill mitigation fund if credits from the approved mitigation bank were not available and at the original time that the payments were made and the mitigation project expenses have not been fully recovered.
All right. Bill Ryan and Chris Castelli, come on up.
So familiar. All BSL all day.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bill Ryan, Assistant Director, the Department of State Lands. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today regarding Senate Bill 249, which would allow the Department of State Lands to recover our costs for wetland mitigation projects in areas where there previously was no wetland mitigation bank. This is a nuanced kind of regulatory concept of mitigation banking and mitigation credit, so I'd like to provide a little bit of background to the committee. The DSL is responsible for implementing the state's removal fill law, which requires permits to, for removing or filling material in wetlands and waterways statewide.
If a project's impacts to wetlands cannot be avoided, we require the permit applicant to compensate for wetland losses through some form of mitigation or compensatory mitigation. And mitigation includes restoring, creating, or enhancing wetlands on a property, basically to offset the effects of the removal and fill activity on wetlands. And so there are different options to do this mitigation. There's on-site mitigation, where the actual project proponent creates or restores wetlands on the same location as where the impacts were occurring. There's off-site mitigation, where they do an individual mitigation project at some other location off of where the impact is occurring. You can purchase credits from a mitigation bank in the vicinity of the project, or if there is no mitigation bank in the area, you can make a payment to the department's removal fill mitigation fund, which is a revolving fund managed by the department. So a mitigation bank is a property where wetlands have been restored, created, or enhanced in advance of a permit need in order to provide mitigation for multiple permits over time. So you're basically banking the enhancement or the increased wetlands functions in advance, and then selling off portions of those increases as permits come up over time. The use of a mitigation bank is often preferable because mitigation banks tend to be more successful in replacing environmental functions. They tend to cost less, and they provide more certainty regarding schedule of getting the mitigation completed and also of getting a permit, and they also tend to just shorten permit time frames. Often one of the challenges for a permit applicant is actually identifying and developing an appropriate mitigation for their project. And if there are mitigation bank credits that are suitable already available, that's just a matter of writing a check and being done. So a much more rapid way of getting your mitigation requirements taken care of. For this reason, there's a market for private mitigation banks in areas of robust development. And so in Oregon, that's primarily in the Portland metro and just the greater Willamette Valley is where most of the private sector mitigation banks are. There are 25 mitigation banks in the state at this time. There is still a need for mitigation bank credits in areas that are not served by existing for-profit mitigation banks. And so, for example, the Oregon Department of Transportation, they recognize the value of having mitigation credits available. They've got impacts all over the state, not necessarily in high development areas, and they still have a mitigation requirement. So they actually have developed 4 different mitigation banks for their own use in different parts of the state. DSL provides mitigation credits in areas where others haven't. So if there are no private bank credits available, we're actually able to take money into the removal fill fund and then use that money to develop mitigation basically for the applicants. And so that actually is an important service that we provide both for economic development, but also for better environmental impacts or better environmental outcomes in development areas. And we do this by selling credits to permittees and then pooling those funds and using those funds to develop our own mitigation projects. And when we develop those mitigation projects, we partner with entities that have experience and expertise in developing wetland mitigation, so watershed councils, conservation groups, land trusts, that sort of thing. And to date, we've developed 6 wetland mitigation projects in various areas of the state, including Forest Grove, Douglas, Lincoln, and Clatsop counties, and also in the Tillamook area. So the removal fill mitigation fund is replenished through the sale of those credits, and then as we get those funds, then we use those funds to invest in mitigation projects in other new areas that are unserved at the time. So the reason for Senate Bill 249 is to address a problem with the current statute. ORS 196.643 allows payment into the mitigation fund only if there are no credits available from an established mitigation bank within the region. And the intent of that statute was to address the concern that the state could possibly sell credits cheaper than the private sector could, so didn't want the state to compete with the private sector. And this had not been a problem until fairly recently. In 2010, the department funded a mitigation project, the Half Mile Lane mitigation project in the Tualatin River watershed. We invested $797,000 from the fund to develop mitigation credits in an area that had a lot of development occurring and a lot of demand from applicants for credits, but there were no private sector banks in the area. And so in the following 14 months, the department actually sold credits to 7 permittees and recouped about $150,000, a little bit over $150,000 of that initial investment from that area. What happened after that is in 2011 and 2012, two private mitigation banker entities came into that same watershed and provided the same kind of credits that the department has had provided. And so we've been unable to recover, you know, sell credits and recover those monies from our initial investment since then. And so basically what it's resulted in is a disincentive for the department to invest in new watersheds that are unserved now, because there's a concern that we wouldn't be able to get the money back and replenish the revolving fund. And so it's been a bit of a dampening for our investment in new watersheds. So Senate Bill 249 would add language in statute to allow the department to sell mitigation credits until we recovered our investment costs. Our current statute basically requires us to sell our credits at a price of basically the cost that it was to generate it. So there's no profit associated with that. We calculate how much it cost to generate those credits for a given project, and that's what the price is per credit for those. The change would not affect established private sector mitigation banks and would only apply in areas that didn't have a private bank when the department first began to sell credit. So it would only apply in an area we were the first entity providing that service. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, one question. Do the private mitigation bank sellers, do they make profits on their credits?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, that certainly is their intent. And, you know, we don't have access to their financial statements, but they definitely do so for profit.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Senator Deborah.
Can you give us a sense of the kinds of transformations that these banks are creating? I mean, you know, presumably these are really promoting the public good by creating these, you know, doing these projects. Can you give us a sense of that, you know, to compensate for the loss of whatever, you know, the removal fill permits require?
Certainly. Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, that can be a really big conversation. But essentially, the history of mitigation, and there's been a requirement in state law and in federal law since the 70s, basically, to offset impacts to wetlands and waterways with mitigation. And the history for the first three decades of that was that these mitigation projects were done, but they were done very poorly and frequently did not really replace the habitat and water quality and other functions of the wetlands and waterways that were affected. They just weren't successful. And so there's been an increase in the requirements, both on the state law as well as federal law, on how you know, how robust your mitigation plan will be. And one of the things that resulted from this is the recognition that by banking, where you are doing large-scale mitigation, and in advance you're able to actually identify adequate or ideal locations to do your mitigation, like areas where you can restore and get a lot of uplift and have a high likelihood of success of your restoration project, tend to result in better environmental in outcomes than, say, 20 different small mitigation sites that are spread in different locations, which are usually done really on an opportunistic basis. Someone is developing a project, and they just look to see, is there a piece of their property that they can put mitigation, they can squeeze mitigation into, what have you. I spent many years actually as a wetland specialist for ODOT and did a lot of squeezing of mitigation sites into right away. And so having a bank available where the actual restoration has resulted in a significant environmental uplift and have the credits available and not have to invest in the location, the design, the acquisition, and the construction and maintenance of that mitigation site is a really high value for project applicants.
Thanks. And if I could follow up. And so who does the oversight and accountability, you know, to make sure that, you know, that there are significant improvements? Is that DSL that does that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, yes, and it's DSL, and actually in order for the credits to count toward federal mitigation requirements with the Army Corps of Engineers, their Section 10 and 404 programs, we actually have an agreement with them regarding the program, and they actually have oversight regarding those mitigation sites as well to make sure that they're performing, they're meeting the standards that are set for those over time in terms of the habitat, the hydrology, the development of the wetland functions on the site.
And just one final question. Are we hearing any complaints from anyone that this program is not working? I haven't been approached by anyone. This is just a question that strikes me.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, no complaints about our in-lieu fee, basically the DSL developed credits. There are, I would say that for the mitigation banking program in general, some folks have challenges with getting approval of their mitigation projects, and that's it's a regulatory process with both the Army Corps of Engineers and DSL, and some folks I think would say that process takes too long.
Thank you.
So there is currently, there are two private mitigation banks that have moved into the same area region as a DSL mitigation bank. Am I understanding that correctly? What's the difference in cost for their credits versus your credit? I'm presuming that, and I don't have a ton of experience in this area of policy, so that's why I'm asking these questions. I'm presuming that they're able to move in because they can sell credits for less, but they're also making money on it. I get your concern. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand all the aspects to this issue before we decide what we're going to do as a committee.
Chair Edwards, I actually don't know what the going rate is for those two banks, and I'd have to check on what the rate. We haven't been selling credits from ours. But basically they don't need to undersell us because we're under current statute, we're not able to sell credits. It's because there's credits available from a private source already, so we can't sell the credits that are in our bank. We'll have to wait for them to sell out their credits, and that at which point we'd be able to sell ours. And just as a point of clarification, the statute would not be retroactive, so that situation would remain under the Bill 249 as it's written. The current status quo would happen with that particular bank.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Nobody else has signed up to testify. There are other people sitting in the hearing room. Does anybody else want to weigh in on this? Mr. Chandler.
Why did you have to do that?
Do we have to?
Come on. Man.
You should be on your bike.
He could have signed up. He missed the boat.
He could have been on the bike, too.
Man. I hear grumbling, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to keep my 45-minute PowerPoint to maybe 44 or 43 minutes, although if I might bear the chair's indulgence, but given the fact that Senator Prozanski wearing his chair hat on in a different committee, in absolute defiance of my on-the-record unvolunteering for a work group, put me on the darn work group. So I'm inclined to just babble here for a while, if you don't mind. Y'all can leave. I'll just tell Senator Prozanski about mitigation banking. I'd like to go back to 1847 when the fish hatchery opened up in Astoria. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here in support of Senate Bill 249. Good bill. Should pass. Any questions?
Okay.
I actually just hung around to put that on the record. I'm protocol that you unvolunteering on the record ought to be a King's X, the way I look at it. But apparently not.
Questions?
But for the record, Mr. Chair and members, I'm not available for any work groups on this bill either.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
I was kind of hoping you'd keep going so that opportunity to gavel you down.
Oh, you'll have plenty of those.
Yeah. Don't get them started, man.
Yeah, I think you have to take a number, though. There's a sign-up sheet someplace.
Oh, thank you. Anybody else want to weigh in on this? Okay. So we were just scheduled for a public hearing today, so we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 249. And we don't have any other business before the committee today, so we are adjourned. Business before the committee today, so we are adjourned.